But you know, brethren, in a few days, our nation will celebrate a day called Thanksgiving. In some ways, it's one of the most important family holidays of the year. And when you consider the concept of giving thanks, you realize that such a day is in reality rare for most human beings. That it seems by nature we have difficulty being thankful. Seems like it's not within the heart of man to pause and give thanks for anything. We live in a day and a time when we see a lot more people who believe they're owed something as opposed to those who want to be thankful for it. The history of the Thanksgiving holiday goes back, at least the tradition of it, goes back many years in this country. The basis for it is kind of loosely based upon the pilgrims, as they were called, or actually they weren't called pilgrims at the time, but later on at Plymouth, or of course some would say the group that was settled in Jamestown who had a similar type of a day or a celebration, I should say, a year before those in Plymouth. But it is a national holiday, and it's one that we as members of God's church can feel good about recognizing. This is much different than the other days. You know, you think of Christmas and Easter that have pagan origins, actually not just origins, are pagan, and so therefore creates a problem and an issue. But Thanksgiving, of course, some have said, well, it's sort of a harvest festival, and that has some pagan roots as well. Well, they've said the same thing, of course, at least some did, and back in 1995 about the Feast of Tabernacles. That it's just it's this harvest festival, and therefore there's some sort of pagan origin there. We don't accept that. Obviously, you can find something pagan back in history, historically. When you go back, and obviously those things occurred, or those things happened. But we're very comfortable with the fact that we recognize a day for giving thanks, but it's not the only day that we give thanks, or at least it should not be the only day. But it's a day that we can have and a day that we can at least focus, and certainly our focus should even be different than most other people in this world today. Now, let's begin this afternoon in Psalm 103. We have a very interesting statement here made by David, in reference to, of course, God himself. Psalm 103, beginning in verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from destruction, who crowns you with loving kindness and tender mercies, who satisfies your mouth with good things, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. And then in verse 9, he will not always strive with you or with us, nor will he keep his anger forever. He has not dealt with us according to our sins, nor punished us according to our iniquities. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame, he remembers that we are dust. It's a very interesting concept here. The Bible in basic English in verse 2 says, give praise to the Lord, O my soul, let not all his blessings go from your memory. To remember what God does, to remember what God has done, not only for us, but when you look at the nation where we live, you can see a stark difference between here and much of the rest of the world. You know, the United States of America and Great Britain, and we'll talk about those as I get further into the sermon today, because I submit to you that the blessings we have in this country are not because we are smarter, more talented, have greater intellect, or any of those things, or even worked harder than anyone else in the world, that we have the blessings we do. And I hope we recognize as we come up to a day of Thanksgiving that we have blessings because of something that happened a long time ago, far beyond our day and age, that are being acted out today in what we see in our nation. Few people really understand the difference. And again, we can often use, there are different places you can use. A lot of my experience is in Africa. You know, there are many stories there as well. Poverty is difficult to explain unless you've seen real poverty. It's difficult to explain to someone in America or the, you know, Europe and other places such as that or a part of the Commonwealth of Britain, or at least formerly a part of it, maybe. It's hard to explain what real poverty is. You go into some of these countries in Africa. I leave for a trip to Ghana in January, and I've been there, I think, 15 times in the last 20 years. And you see it over and over again. You kind of get used to it. It doesn't affect you the way it did the first time. But you realize that so many people there, many of the brethren, live in mud huts, homes, thatch roofs, and dirt floors. The country of Ghana, which is one of the more progressive countries in Africa, over half the people in that country don't have electricity. And I remember being in, actually it was in Zambia a few years back when a lot of things were happening, and the members lived in that way, and a lot of people lived that way in that part of, in that country as well. And, but they all had cell phones. You know, the Chinese have come in and built cell towers everywhere, so they all have cell phones. Which is a little surprising. No electricity, no running water, dirt floors, but they have a cell phone. And I'd ask them, I said, well, how did you get information? And of course they pointed to their cell phone. We have internet access. And they were able to follow a lot of things that are happening in our country, happening in the church at that time, through that. But the way most people live, the things that you see in that particular area are quite distressing, quite overwhelming. As I said, you kind of get used to it over time, but you never completely are able to get it out of your mind. This is what real poverty looks like. You know, if you begin to compare this country, and I know probably many of you have seen some of these things before, but few really understand, I believe, here in this country, the great wealth that we have. In our country, the average person, and this is a few years ago, I think within the last 10 years certainly, the average American, man, woman, and child, spends $16,000 per year. The average person, you know, multiply by 325 million people, whatever it is. The average person, man, woman, and child, spends about $16,000 a year. In Somalia, the average person spends $17 a year. $17 a year. The average American shopper this coming Friday, Black Friday, will spend $700, the average American. Largest shopping day of the year. The U.S. has 6% of the world's population, but 50% of the world's wealth. In the world, the reported amount of money spent on the military is $900 billion, give or take. The U.S. spends half of all the money spent in the world on military. Now, again, you could argue and say, well, but our military is weaker now. And you know, all of those things are true, I'm sure. But half of the world's money or wealth that's spent on military is spent by the United States. The average person in Ghana, where I'll be going, as I said, in January, makes less than $30 per month. Have we, you and me, Americans, earned all of these blessings? Are we more deserving of these blessings than anyone else in the world? Or is there something else going on? Is there something specific about this country, about the people who settled this country, that makes for who we are today? Who we are today. Now let's step back for a moment. I had a very interesting period of time in my life when my family and I were moved from Georgia to Massachusetts. I've told the story before, and my mother repeats it over and over again, that my grandmother, her mother, when she heard we were moving to Massachusetts, says, where on earth is Massachusetts? Is that some communist country you're moving to? And she really didn't know where Massachusetts was. She didn't know what part of the country that was. Moving from the South to New England was a big deal. It was a lot that went on in making a move like that. But when we moved to Massachusetts, our first Thanksgiving there, we moved there in the summer of 1979. Our first Thanksgiving there, which would have been the next year, we'd already gone through a winter and we'd gone through a summer, and we were now coming to the fall, which is just beautiful in New England. And we had no family. So we decided we would go to Plymouth, and we'd not been there before. And in Plymouth, every year, they have, at Thanksgiving, they have a reenactment of the Pilgrim's Landing. They have the, you know, Plymouth Rock is there, which is pretty small. It's actually not a very big deal. But they do a reenactment. And then they have a community meal at Pilgrim Hall, where they feed the, anyone who comes, they feed you there. So we decided we would do that with our family, go over, spend the night, spend the day, spend the night, look around, see things. And it was really quite impressive. And in the years that followed, we often did that on Thanksgiving. Not often, I shouldn't say. Maybe a couple of times we did that. But we learned a lot about those people. And there were an incredible group of people that came over from England. If you know the story, it was in August of 1620 that two ships, the Mayflower and the, Spindrift. I'll get it right in a moment. I'll find it somewhere. But there were two ships that were leaving from England, and they were to come to America. They were to come to the colonies. And they were headed for Virginia, though. They didn't get very far out when one of the ships experienced a great deal of problems. In fact, the problems were so severe that they had to turn around and go back. Speedwell was the name of the other ship. I knew I'd think of it. They had to turn around and go back. The Speedwell was left because it had so many problems. And so they were delayed. And finally, they loaded everyone who still wanted to go onto the Mayflower. 102 people on the Mayflower that finally left from England. Now, these people were composed of, there was a good chunk of the people, not all of the people, were from a group that called themselves separatists. They actually had left England because they had difficulties with the Church of England and went to Holland, went to the Netherlands, and stayed there for more than a decade. But then their children were growing up with a Dutch background. They didn't want their children being Dutch culturally. So they went back to England. But the Church of England was no less or no more tolerant than they had been before. And so the separatists were really a part of the Puritan movement. The Puritans wanted to purify the Church of England, and many of them left for the New World because they couldn't affect the changes there. The Puritans were opposed to idols. They were opposed to a lot of the Catholicism that the Church of England held on to. They also were opposed to things, or many of them were opposed to things like Christmas. In fact, the separatists were very much opposed to that. In fact, even to this day, it is against the law in the state of Massachusetts to put up a Christmas tree. I can assure you it's never enforced, but it's against the law. And the fine is one night in jail and 5 shillings if you put up a Christmas tree. They were opposed to those things. They didn't want to be a part of the Church of England, so they were called separatists. They followed their pastor, whose name was John Robinson, who took them to the Netherlands, brought them back to England, and then decided they had to leave and come to the New World. So they were to head for Virginia. That's where they were headed, for Virginia. They spent 66 days on board ship. 102 people on board the ship that was about 90 feet long by 26 feet wide. It was calculated that every man, woman, and child had a space on board that ship of 6 feet by 3 feet. That's how much space you had for 66 days. Now, during the feast in Orange Beach, there was a group of individuals who got the big idea of going fishing out in the Gulf. They went out 14 miles. The waters were choppy. Everyone got sick. They all had to come back. They were out for a few hours. These people spent 66 days on board this ship. 66 days. The group were referred to as, they weren't called pilgrims, they were referred to as saints and strangers. There were 25 crewmen on board the ship. We had no real religious affiliation. In fact, when they first landed off Provincetown, and then, of course, later on in Plymouth, the strangers were observing Christmas. They got off the boat. They were having a big celebration for Christmas. The saints, as they referred to themselves, stayed on board. So they would not participate in this pagan custom as they saw it at that time. The term pilgrim didn't come into existence until many years later. They were referred to as pilgrims from a verse in Hebrews 11. They referred to themselves as pilgrims. Most of the information about these people came from William Bradford, who wrote of Plymouth Plantation. And it's a book that has an interesting story itself. The book was lost, or the manuscript was lost for many years, and it was discovered in a Boston restaurant wrapped up with fish and chips. They discovered this rare book and finally retrieved it. It had been lost for like 20 years. No one knew where it was. And so they retrieved it. Of course, they had a copy of it then. Now, there were other copies, but this was the original written by William Bradford. which itself was quite an interesting story. But when they first landed at Provincetown out on the tip of Cape Cod, but the weather was so strong, the wind was so strong, there was no safe haven, so they moved on around and finally found Plymouth Harbor, which was a safe place. It was calm. The ocean was calm there, and it was a place they could settle. But now we're into December. They prepared to go to Virginia. They were ready for the Virginia weather. And they landed in Plymouth, and it was horrendous. William Bradford records it, the temperature never got above freezing from the time they landed until the spring of the year. Ice and cold. It's also recorded it was one of the coldest winters ever in New England, according to the records from that period of time that actually you could find. It was one of the worst and brutal winters. 102 people. Two people died on board the ship going over. One baby was born, and they named her Oceanus, born on the ship on the ocean. Two died. So they came ashore. They signed what became known as the Mayflower Compact, in which they agreed in religious free exercise of religion and a lot of other things that they wanted in this new colony. But that winter, 50 of them died. Half of the people died that first winter. You want to know the kind of people they were? Half of the people died. But they couldn't bury them and put a stick up over the grave because they were afraid that the Indians, the Native Americans, would see it, and they were worried. The Wampanoag Indian tribe surrounded them, and they had no idea if they could survive until they met a fellow by the name of Squanto, who actually was not a Wampanoag, but he was with the Wampanoags, and he had been captured by John Smith on a previous voyage, had been taken to England as a slave, had escaped from England, but he understood English, and came back and was there with the Wampanoags when the Pilgrims landed. And he was an advocate for them, and he translated for them. And so in the spring of 1621, they entered into an agreement with them to have peace. They taught them how to plant corn. They didn't know how to do that. They taught them how to have their produce that spring, or put their produce out that spring, and of course collect it later on. So it was in the fall of 1621, after a devastating winter, after all of the problems they had. Of course, they had an opportunity to go back on the Mayflower in the spring. Not a single person went back to England after the brutal winter that they had experienced. They were thankful. They were appreciative. It wasn't a matter of them saying or feeling like, well, you know, we did all this ourselves. They were thankful. And as they gathered in that fall, they were appreciative that they were alive, that they had food to eat. The only food they had prior to the fall of 1621 was what they brought with them from England. And you can imagine the state of it after almost a year. And that's what they were eating. Many that died of malnourishment, the cold, what was probably just the flu or influenza that spread among them, and it took their lives. Many women, many children, and several of the men as well that died that very first winter. But that is not really, it's not really the story of Thanksgiving. It's a part of it. It's a part of the history that we hear about. See, it wasn't until 1789, 150 years later, that George Washington declared a day of Thanksgiving. After he was selected for the first president, after the Constitution, of course, had been approved, after the war was over, he declared to this new country that we need to take a day and give thanks. A day of Thanksgiving was proclaimed by George Washington. It was followed by Adams and Madison, but then it was discontinued for many years in the United States, until we come to the time of Abraham Lincoln. It was on October the 3rd, 1863, in the middle of the Civil War, that Abraham Lincoln sent out a proclamation. This is now 240 years after the Pilgrims landed, after they had a celebration, a three-day celebration, because they were thankful to be alive. And they didn't think it was all because of them. They were hardy people. They were strong people. They were dedicated people. But they knew that they should not have survived. It was more than just them. Abraham Lincoln wrote in a proclamation on October 3rd, 1863, The year that is drawing towards its close has been filled with the blessings of fruitful fields and healthful skies. To these bounties, which are so constantly enjoyed that we are prone to forget the source from which they come, others have been added, which are so of such an extraordinary of nature that they cannot fail to penetrate and soften even the heart which is habitually insensible to the ever-watchful providence of Almighty God. Population has steadily increased, notwithstanding the waste that has been made in the camp, the siege in the battlefield, and of the country. Rejoicing in the consciousness of augmented strength and vigor is permitted to expect continuance of years with large increase of freedom. No human counsel has devised, nor has any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, has nevertheless remembered mercy. It has seemed to me fit and proper that they should be solemnly, reverently, and gratefully acknowledged as with one heart and one voice by the whole American people. And he declared for the first time that the fourth Thursday in November would be a day of thanksgiving. It was a remarkable thing, but it wasn't until 1941 that was a proclamation. In 1941, the U.S. Congress passed the bill that created Thanksgiving as a national holiday on the fourth Thursday in the month of November, and has been a part of our national heritage, our country since that time. But I come back to my question again. We have so many blessings, so much. Here Abraham Lincoln was writing about the great blessings of this country in the middle of the Civil War, when more Americans died than in any war in U.S. history. It was a brutal war. It took a great toll on human beings in this country. In the middle of that, though, he talks about the greatness. He talks about the blessings that this nation has. And not because we deserved it, but because of something else. Now, what Abraham Lincoln knew, I really don't know. Look at Hebrews 11, verse 13. This is where the term pilgrims came from. It was actually coined for the first time in 1821, well after the separatists and the saints and strangers landed in Plymouth Harbor. Hebrews 11, verse 13. It was in retrospect that an author wrote about those people as being these people. Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in the faith, or in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. From this, the author attached the name pilgrims to these individuals, and that name sticks to this very day. It was the pilgrims who landed. As I said, they referred to themselves and the crewmen on board the ship as saints and strangers. The strangers, of course, were those who were not religious, and the saints were those who were. But they all landed in Plymouth Harbor in 1620. Now, when viewed from the perspective of world history, can the story of America be anything but a miracle? But are we the smartest and the greatest people the world has ever seen? Or is it, as Abraham Lincoln stated, we have been blessed by God, in spite of ourselves at times. We have been blessed by God. Let's go to Daniel chapter 4. Let's step back and take a bit of a world view of what this is all about and what's happened in the world. There's a remarkable incident that's recorded in the book of Daniel about a king named Nebuchadnezzar, where God challenged Nebuchadnezzar because he thought he accomplished all the great things that were around him. He thought he deserved them. He thought he was owed them because of who he was. And God chose this example at this moment in time to make a point and a lesson for humanity, really. Although you find that humanity has failed to get the lesson, but God gave a lesson. Daniel chapter 4, verse 23. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of an empire. Nebuchadnezzar has the wealthiest empire the world has ever seen to that point in time. Daniel saw him as the head of gold. Gold picturing, of course, the great wealth that he had. But Nebuchadnezzar had serious flaws, obviously. But he had one flaw that God wanted to at least make him aware of. The flaw was that he felt he deserved everything. That it was all his doing. That he was a great king. He went out and conquered the world of that day. Well, there's something God wants Nebuchadnezzar to learn, and it's a lesson that humanity has failed to learn over and over again. And sometimes, even in our own country, we want to take credit for all that God has given us, as though we deserve it. Look what we did. Look what we accomplished. Look who we are. Is that really true? Daniel 4, verse 23. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, he had a dream, a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, come down the tree, or chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it all be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. So there's a prophecy that Nebuchadnezzar was going to lose his mind, and he was going to wander around like an animal for 7 years. Well, Nebuchadnezzar couldn't believe that. That wasn't going to happen. Yet that's what he's being told, this dream revealed. Then look at verse 28. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, a year later, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? I did all of this, he said. I created all of this. I am so great that I did it all. Verse 31, while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you until you know what? That the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. Nebuchadnezzar, you only exist because I allow it. Nebuchadnezzar, you only have these things because I allowed it. It isn't because you were so great. And from that hour, he became a madman, became like an animal, eating grass in the field. You know, how different can that be from being the king to wandering around the fields like an animal for 7 years? At the moment he said that, it's as though God wanted a lesson for humanity. Don't ever forget who's really in charge. Don't forget who really controls things. It isn't you. It isn't me. God himself makes these determinations. If you look at the United States of America, and you look at all the great blessings that we have, and you look back at history, you will discover, and I think all of you are aware of certainly our teaching and our understanding of this, that it's all because of one human being. One human being. Not because of him in that sense that he did all of this, but he did something so remarkable that God said, I will bless your descendants. And I'm not just going to bless them. They're going to become the greatest people that the world has ever seen. And nations will come from them. Did God fulfill that promise? And is that where we are today? Because of that. You know, the Old Testament, the book of Genesis, is a book of beginnings. That's why it's called Genesis. It's also a book of firsts, describing how things developed in human history. We read the very first verse in the Bible as, in the beginning, God. We also know that God there is Elohim, plural. There's something else here about God that isn't quite so obvious. It's in the Old Testament, but not quite as obvious. And then, of course, the New Testament reveals what really happened. And that this God who walked the earth and talked with individuals, met with individuals, often called the angel of Yahweh, referred to even as Yahweh, who spoke to people, was the one who became Jesus Christ. And then John 1:1 describes, in the beginning, the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So that begins to open a door and answers a lot of questions. It tells us a lot about God as well, that God is creating a family, that God has a plan for that family. The Old Testament tells us about a physical family that God took in, so to speak. made his family in that sense, physically, the nation of Israel. And the New Testament tells us about a spiritual family that God is creating, the church of God, of all races, all nationalities, all people. But it didn't change some of the physical things and promises that were given in the Old Testament. It's quite a remarkable story, and it revolves around one human being. Let's go back to Genesis 12. The story I submit to you of our blessings today revolve around one human being and his relationship with God. If you read, this story is so remarkable, it's so almost impossible to wrap your arms around it as to who this man was and what this man accomplished or what he did in his relationship with God. Genesis chapter 12, we read about, we're introduced to him in chapter 11, but we read about a man named Abram. He was later, of course, to be named Abraham. But Abram in chapter 12, verse 1, is already 75 years old. This is somewhere around 1800 B.C. This is 800 to 900 years before there was ever a temple built in Jerusalem. This is also only about 200 years since Noah died. You know, Noah lived 300 years after the flood. The flood was probably about 400 years or so, 500 years maybe before Abraham. So Abraham is living, or Abram, within 300 to 400 years of Noah. So there aren't a lot of nations in the world by when Abram is here. That's why it's so significant that God promises him there are going to be all these nations come from you. Abram had to look around, and even after, you know, 400 or 500 years after the flood, how many people are there on the face of the earth? The scattering that occurred in Genesis 11, we talk about the Tower of Babel, that sent people further away. But God is making promises to Abram at age 75. Now, he's going to live for another 100 years. His 75 is not the same as our 75 today. As I said, he's going to live for another 100 years. But he already has a relationship with God. We don't read a lot about it. But it's a type of relationship that God speaks to him directly in verse 1. See, Abram didn't have to wonder if it was God speaking to him. It wasn't that he had some kind of dream. And in that dream, he said, well, God told me this or God told me that. No, God told him and walked with him and talked with him. The Yahweh we read of here in the Old Testament. And the Lord said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. From Ur of the Chaldees to a land called Haran, he is now coming to Canaan. He says, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you, I will make you a great nation. So I said, you know, we're talking about a period of time when there probably aren't a lot of nations, period. Tribal groups here and there scattered around the world, but organized countries or nations, I'm sure there were some. What are we talking about? Nothing like we would think of today. But he said, I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families, notice they're called families of the earth, shall be blessed. The earth is just beginning to be repopulated. Now, so God says, you're to go. Abram had a couple of reactions. He could say, well, no, I don't want to go. I like my family. I like this area. I'm going to stay here. Or he could have said, I'll go later, you know, as we heard in the sermonette. What did he do? According to the Bible, he didn't say anything. He simply left, verse 4. This is the kind of relationship this man had with God, and this was what God saw in this man. As far as we know, he never said anything. He went back, and he packed up, and he left. There's something unusual about that. You don't see that attitude or approach very often. In fact, this man, Abram, is quite unique. He took his wife, verse 5, his Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. But God made a great promise to Abram, later became Abraham. He repeats that promise approximately 6 or 7 times, depending on how you count the times, over the next 30 years of Abraham's life. And then we come to Genesis 22. He's now Abraham. This is about 30 years later. He's just around 100, maybe a little over 100 years of age at this time. Once again, God gives him a direct order. Again, it wasn't as though, you know, we're not talking about someone today who has this crazy dream and tells you, well, you know, God told me in this dream you're supposed to go out and, you know, do whatever. Or God told me I'm going to go and do this or whatever. You know, this sort of, I had this dream. Abraham wasn't having dreams per se. He was talking to God. And he knew who he was. The same one who was in the Garden of Eden is talking to Abraham. The same one that met with Noah. The same one that destroyed the world with a flood. Abraham knows who he's talking to. And this being came to Abraham. Chapter 22, verse 1. Came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Then he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains on which I shall tell you. Now, that's obviously an unusual request. It must not have been unusual and probably wasn't in that day that human sacrifice was done. Abraham was no doubt familiar with it being done, but not by God, not by the people that he was working with directly. So it had to be an odd request. But Abraham was there. God was there. He heard him clearly. Abraham, again, didn't answer, didn't say a word. Verse 3, he rose up in the morning and took his son, took some wood, and departed for Mount Moriah. Now, the interesting thing about Mount Moriah, it was probably already a known place for worship of the true God. And, of course, later on, this is where the temple is going to be. But that's 800 or 900 years later before the temple is going to stand in that spot. But this was a special spot. It wasn't just any place that God said, okay, take him out in your backyard or take him down the road. He says, no, bring him to Mount Moriah and sacrifice him. Abraham comes to Mount Moriah. You know the story. He's prepared to sacrifice his son. He never said a word that is recorded. He packed up and left just as he did some 30 years prior. Isaac was probably a young man, maybe late teens, early 20s. He was not an infant by any means at this time. And Abraham is going to take his life. And of course, you know the story, and of course, there are a lot of comparisons. God gave his son. Abraham was asked to give up his son. And we see a lot of these things going on, these parallels that occurred. And of course, as he's about to kill his son, they find a ram caught in the thicket. And this becomes the sacrifice, and Abraham is told to take that as a sacrifice. But after this, we find out that God said something about Abraham, something that was very special about Abraham. He's later on called a friend of God, the only human being that we read of in Scripture that was ever called a friend of God, someone that God spent time with, someone who was that close to God. He's called the father of the faithful. But after this incident, God said, I now know for sure. Now, he lives another 70 years. But God says, I know this man isn't going to turn away. And he wasn't. And God repeated his promise. I'm going to make of you a great nation. Actually, many great nations are going to come for you, or many nations will come from you. And the whole world will be blessed by you. The whole world will be blessed. They won't know it. But the whole world will be blessed by you because the Messiah will come through you. Now, Abraham, we don't know how much he understood about that, but he understood the blessings that God had promised to him. Now, there are those today who will say, well, but those promises were fulfilled in Israel, the golden age of Israel, which about 800 years later, you have Solomon and David, and it was called the golden age. They had a lot of wealth, they had a lot of things. But how can you compare living in 1000 BC and the things that you had available to you then and living in 2016 AD? You think that was the greatest there could be in 1000 BC? You could have gold, you could stack as high as you want. That doesn't make up for all the things that now exist that they could even think about. In 1000 BC. They couldn't think about it. They couldn't imagine electricity. They couldn't imagine transportation. They couldn't imagine any of those things that we have today as a part of the blessings I mentioned. There are many countries, and Ghana being one of them, that over half the people in that country do not have electricity or running water. We have it everywhere. You can't compare the golden age of Israel and say this was the greatest time in human history for blessings. There has to be something else that God had in mind. Look at Genesis chapter 48. This, of course, is the incident that passes this birthright promise. It goes from Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, and Jacob to Joseph. And God honors his promise all the way down. And here we have a change that occurs, and yet God is a part of it. We see that Jacob, or Israel, knows what to do. And he has this insight from God as to what he's supposed to do. This is the example in verse 12 of Genesis 48. And Joseph brought them, that's his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. Manasseh was the oldest son, Ephraim was the youngest son. Then Israel stretched out his hand, right hand, and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. How did he know that? Where did he get his direction from? And he blessed Joseph. The same blessing that was given to Abraham, given to Isaac, given to Jacob, is now given to Joseph through his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And you know the story. Of course, our new booklet goes through, and I think a very interesting way, this story that we've known about for a long time, God's blessing on Ephraim and Manasseh, producing what became the British Empire, and of course what became the United States of America, the greatest single nation, the greatest conglomerate of nations. The British Empire ruled the world, the majority of the world, or a large portion of the world, for almost 300 years. No one had ever seen anything like it. The Roman Empire was just a shadow compared to that. It wasn't even one-fourth the size of the British Empire. The wealth and the influence that the British had for 300 years is unknown in world history. And then, of course, in the 20th century, another nation comes on the scene, or a nation comes on the scene, that has great promise. It's the only nation in the history that we in world history, certainly this size, that actually consumed so much land or came into possession of so much land in such a short period of time. Such a short period of time, spreading from the east to the west in a very short period of time. The promises in Deuteronomy chapter 28 have been bestowed upon Ephraim and Manasseh, their descendants today. Let's go to Psalm chapter 33, verse 12. Psalm 33, verse 12. I submit to you, brethren, that we have these great blessings in this country that we should be very thankful for. Not because it's our right, not because we were born as an American in that sense, because we were so great, because we did so many wonderful things. There are obviously good traits about the United States of America and good traits about the British. But there are also some bad traits and some bad things that have happened, you know, in the last, 400 years in human history that just weren't right, weren't good. But there is a certain element there of giving back or giving to others, generosity that our countries have certainly experienced. But the world, if you look at it from a perspective of the world, how did we get all of this? How do we deserve this and they don't deserve it? And I submit to you because of one man and one name, Abraham, not Abraham Lincoln, Abraham, that we have what we have today. Psalm 33, verse 12. Says, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he has chosen as his own inheritance. Blessed is the nation. Now, we can argue and say, and I would agree with that, that this nation has gone astray almost from the very beginning when it comes to worshiping the true God. They had certain principles, but they didn't have it all there. They were not very tolerant of the Sabbath keepers who came into New England in the 1600s as well. In fact, if you were a Sabbath keeper in Massachusetts, then you were apt to be imprisoned by the Puritans. They didn't want you. If you fly into the city of Boston today, Boston has a unique airport. It's out on an island in Boston Harbor. You land on an island just so you can see downtown Boston. And when you're landing on that island, you fly over a little piece of land, and there are some old buildings that are torn down or decayed on this little piece of land. It's called Noodles Island. If you were a Sabbath keeper or any other religious person besides the Puritans, then you were apt to be imprisoned on this little island, Noodles Island. It wasn't just in prison. They put you there, they locked you up, and they never fed you. You just died. No food, no water, anything. You just were locked up in a cell, and there you were left to die. And that was it. So we can say, well, you know, did they ever really worship the true God? They had the values, they had certain principles, and they built upon those principles. But the fact that you say, well, I'm worshiping God, people say that today who go to, you name the church. So it isn't as though they did all of that well, or they even did it right, but they are, or we are, God's inheritance. That is, God, as he said to Nebuchadnezzar, I'm in charge. And I'm going to give, because of Abraham, these wonderful blessings to these people. And here we are, 2016, a nation that is in many ways very divided, very difficult to see, well, what's really going on? And you have so many who believe they have a right to have all of these great things. Is that true? Do any of us have a right? Or is it not, as we come to a day of Thanksgiving, we in God's church get on our knees and thank God for what he's done for us and what he's done through this country for us as well? Because we don't deserve it. And if that's our attitude, I believe we go back to where Abraham was, where Abraham never declared he earned anything or that God owed him anything, but he thanked God for everything. You know, giving thanks is not only a Christian principle that we all recognize, it's a necessity in God's way of life. In fact, we find that God is very, not dismissive, but very, you might say, bothered by the other attitude of we deserve this, we're owed this, or I should have this. Look at James chapter 1. You come to this spiritual family now, you move beyond the physical nation of Israel that God gave so many things to, and that through Abraham, God has blessed us as he has today. James chapter 1. Not only are we to be thankful, we know that, we understand that, but God says we're to even be thankful when times are bad, when bad things are happening. You know, the old title of the book written by Rabbi Kushner, when bad things happen to good people. You can be doing things as best you can, and bad things can happen. As I've seen it in my experience, and you've seen it as well, that it isn't a measure of your faithfulness that tragedy occurs to you or your family. Tragedy happens in this life, and it will happen as we go forward into the future. But God says through James chapter 1, verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. So even when times are bad, you still come to God. You don't stop praying because you're in a trial. Neither do you demand that, well, God, you owe me this or that. You can claim promises when you pray to God, but you come to God and you give God thanks for what he's done for you physically and spiritually in spite of difficult conditions. 2 Timothy chapter 3. One of the signs of the end time is what? 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times or stressful times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. God makes it very clear, and I believe this is why Abraham was such a special person. He never spoke back to God and said, but you owe me this or you owe me that. The only time we record Abraham actually having a dialogue back and forth with God is when? When God is about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah and he wants to plead for Lot. Not himself, but Lot. God gave Abraham something very special. And he put within his hand a promise that I submit to you that today we're living out. How much longer we'll live it out before, you know, at some point God says, look, I'm in charge, and at some point I'm going to end it. I am. That's what he said. 2 Timothy 3, we're told that unthankfulness is a problem in the end time. Look at Luke chapter 17. Here's a wonderful example that Christ gave to signify, you know, this is the same one who walked and talked with Abraham. And look what he says here in Luke chapter 17, verse 11. It says, "Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, 'Jesus, Master, have mercy on us.' So when he saw them, he said to them, 'Go show yourselves to the priest.' And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed." 10 individuals healed of leprosy. "And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan." He was of a different group. The Samaritans were individuals who were brought into Samaria when they took the Israelites out. When they were taken into captivity, they were replaced by foreigners. Samaritans weren't of Israel. The Samaritans weren't of the Jews. They were foreigners. God is no respecter of persons. This person that came back, it was distressful in one sense because he was the Samaritan in the group. Maybe the others were all Israelites or Jews. And they never came back. The people that had the great blessings, the Samaritans weren't promised these things. And then on top of that, they're all healed. Not a very good thing to do. Not to give God thanks in an occasion like this. So Jesus answered and said, "Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner?" And he said to him, "Arise, go your way. Your faith has made you well." Is there any doubt that God expects appreciation? God expects us to give thanks, not just one day a year, but every single day. Look at Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. Verse 14. "But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful." What is he asking of you and me? Be thankful. Verse 16, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him." There is something very special about giving thanks. There's something very special about being appreciative for all that we have, physically as well as spiritually. You know, even in the midst of some of the most poverty-stricken areas in the world, God still expects us to be thankful. God doesn't expect any more of our members in Ghana than he does of us. Now, they have a lot less than we do physically. But they've come to realize it isn't about the physical. They understand that. At least those that are converted understand that. And they understand that their appreciation is for what God has done for them, revealing the truth to them, giving them a new life in the middle of a very dark continent. You know, the lack of things throughout Africa. As one individual told me, it's the curse of Africa. And I said, "What is the curse of Africa?" He said, "Corrupt government. Corrupt government. People come into power and make all kinds of promises. They prove themselves to be corrupt. They enrich themselves, and they will never leave office. They'll change the constitution that they can keep serving if it's an elective process, or they will simply take over as a dictator." If they don't leave office very often in Africa, they're either killed or they die. They don't leave. That's the way it is. He said, that's the curse of Africa. We can never have anything but corrupt government. We never have anything but corrupt government. Of course, governments have become corrupt and have been corrupt for many decades, and we see that ourselves at times. What an indictment, though. Or I should say, what an attitude. An indictment of that, but what an attitude that, well, we have things to be thankful for. We have things to be appreciative for. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. Our biggest concern, or I should say one of our biggest things here in the United States of America, is that we can take so much for granted, physically and spiritually. We live in a country where we can meet in peace and quiet. We don't have to worry about being arrested and put on an island somewhere and locked away in prison because we keep the Sabbath. So that, with all of that here today, we can become complacent. Paul warned the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, "Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." This time of year, of course, as I said, it's not just one day that we give thanks, but it's a time of year that we can look at all of these blessings that we have, all of the things that we see around us, all that we can do today in this country, and be appreciative for it and thank God for it. But being careful that we don't take it for granted, as though this is something that we are owed. It's been all of our lives. Now, I suppose maybe some of us have lived other places, but most of us have lived here all of our lives. And this is what we've come to expect. This is the way life is. This is normal for us. I'll tell you, it's not normal in much of the world. Out of the 7.5 billion people on earth, almost half of them don't even have what we consider, you know, something is everywhere, a flush toilet, or the ability for something to have something like that. 3.5 billion people don't have that on earth today. We have great blessings physically because of the faith and obedience of Abraham. Joseph was our forefather. Ephraim and Manasseh were his sons. And we trace all of this great blessing and wealth all the way back to the family, all the way back to Abraham. It's sad today if we look around and we see that obviously even among our own midst, we have people that are sick, people that suffer, and people that hurt. It's hard sometimes to be thankful when you are in pain or when you're suffering or when things aren't going well. You know, God said, look, I'm in charge. I'm in charge. And just as Abraham was prepared to give his life over to God and even his son's life, so must we. And trust God, give God thanks and appreciation for what he's done. You know, I think back to the days we lived in New England, and I still cherish those opportunities to go out to Plymouth. And I remember the first time I saw Plymouth Rock. I mean, it is a small little thing. I thought, is this all there is? And of course, nobody even knew what was Plymouth Rock. And one day somebody walked down. I mean, they had to make up this story that, well, we landed on this rock, and therefore this rock became a symbol. It really was more of a symbol. Nobody knows where the rock was. So they went down on the beach and they grabbed a rock because everybody was asking for it. They grabbed a rock, brought it up, put it in the middle of town, and it sat there for, I don't know, 50, 60 years, and people kept chiseling away at it. Everybody wanted a piece of the rock, and so they were after it. So finally they decided, well, we better put this thing in a safe place because this could be a moneymaker for us in the future when people want to come and see Plymouth Rock. So they built this little concrete thing, or barrier around it, put it down in a little hole, and carved 1620 on it as though the pilgrims had put it there, which they didn't. And it broke in two when they were trying to put it there. So they had to glue it back together. So here you got Plymouth Rock with this big crack in it and 1620 carved on the side, and tourists come by the thousands to see Plymouth Rock. But it's a symbol, though. It really is. And I understand and appreciate that. But understanding a little bit more about those people, and yet their understanding that it wasn't from them. And it was they gathered after that first brutal winter, and they were able to celebrate. It wasn't that we did this. Look what we did. It was that God had done something special for them. And God had done something special, really, for Abraham, that brought them, that brought us, and that have given us what we have today.